When these things of the ancient regime had vanished, it seemed as if they had never mattered. What did matter was that for all their votes and enfranchisement, and in spite of all their passion and effort, common men were still not free and not enjoying an equal happiness, that the immense promise and air of a new world with which the revolution had come remained unfulfilled. Yet after all, this wave of revolution had realized nearly everything that had been clearly thought out before it came. It wasn't failing now for want of impetus, but for want of finished ideas. Many things that had oppressed mankind were swept away forever. Now that they were swept away, it became apparent how unprepared men were for the creative opportunities this clearance gave them. And periods of revolution are periods of action. In them, men reap the harvests of ideas that have grown during phases of interlude, and they leave the fields cleared for a new season of growth, but they can't suddenly produce ripened new ideas to meet an unanticipated riddle. The sweeping away of king and lord, of priest and inquisitor, of landlord and tax-gatherer and tax-master, left the mass of men face to face for the first time with certain very fundamental aspects of the social structure. Relationships they had taken for granted, and had never realized the need of thinking hard and continuously about before. Institutions that had seemed to be in the nature of things, and matters that had seemed to happen by the same sort of necessity that brought round the dawn and springtime, were discovered to be artificial, controllable. Were they not so perplexingly intricate, and, now that the old routines were abolished and done away with, in urgent need of control? The new order found itself confronted with three riddles which it was quite unprepared to solve: property, currency, and international relationship. Let's take these three problems in order, and ask what they are and how they arose in human affairs. Every human life is deeply entangled in them and concerned in their solution. The rest of this history becomes more and more clearly the development of the effort to solve these problems, and is to say, so to interpret property, so to establish currency, and so to control international reactions as to render possible a worldwide, progressive, and happy community of will. They are the three riddles of the Sphinx of fate, to which the human commonweal must find an answer or perish. The idea of property arises out of the combative instincts of the species. Long before men were men, the ancestral ape was a proprietor. Primitive property is what a beast will fight for: the dog and his bone, the tigress and her lair, the roaring stag and his herd. These are proprietorship blazing. No more nonsensical expression is conceivable in sociology than the term primitive communism. The old man of the family tribe of early Paleolithic times insisted upon his proprietorship in his wives and daughters, in his tools, in his visible universe. If any other man wandered into his visible universe, he fought him, and if he could, he slew him. The tribe grew in the course of ages, as Atkinson showed convincingly in his Primal Law, by the gradual toleration by the old man of the existence of the younger men, and of their proprietorship in the wives they captured from outside the tribe, and in the tools and ornaments they made, and the game they slew. Human society grew by a compromise between this one's property and that. It was largely a compromise and an alliance forced upon men by the necessity of driving some other tribe out of its visible universe. If the hills and forests and streams were not your land or my land, it was because they had to be our land. Each of us would have preferred to have it my land, but that wouldn't work. In that case, the other fellows would have destroyed us. Society, therefore, is, from its beginnings, the mitigation of ownership. Ownership in the beast and in the primitive savage was far more intense a thing than it is in the civilized world today. It's rooted more strongly in our instincts than in our reason. In the natural savage and in the untutored man today, for it's well to keep in mind that no man today is more than 400 generations from the primordial savage, there is no limitation to the sphere of ownership. Whatever you can fight for, you can own. Womenfolk, spared captive, captured beast, forest glade, stone pit, or what not. As the community grew and a sort of law came to restrain internecine fighting, men developed rough and ready methods of settling proprietorship. Men could own what they were the first to make, or capture, or claim. It seemed natural that a debtor who couldn't pay up should become the property of his creditor. Equally natural was it that after claiming a patch of land, bag's eye, as the schoolboy says, a man should exact payments and tribute from anyone else who wanted to use it. It was only slowly, as the possibilities of organized life dawned on men, that this unlimited property in anything whatever began to be recognized as a nuisance. Men found themselves born into a universe all owned and claimed. Nay, they found themselves born owned and claimed. The social struggles of the earlier civilization are difficult to trace now, but the history we've told of the Roman Republic shows a community waking up to the idea that they may become a public inconvenience and should then be repudiated, and that the unlimited ownership of land is also an inconvenience. We find that later Babylonia severely limited the rights of property in slaves. Finally, we find in the teaching of that great revolutionist, Jesus of Nazareth, such an attack upon property as had never been before. Easier it was, he said, for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for the owner of great possessions to enter the kingdom of heaven. A steady, continuous criticism of the permissible scope of property seems to have been going on in the world for the last 25 or 30 centuries. 1900 years after Jesus of Nazareth, we find all the world that has come under the Christian teaching persuaded that there could be no property in persons. There has been a turnover in the common conscience in that matter. And also the idea that a man may do what he likes with his own was clearly very much shaken in relation to other sorts of property. But this world of the closing 18th century was still only in the interrogative stage in this matter. It had got nothing clear enough, much less settled enough, to act upon. One of its primary impulses was to protect property against the greed and waste of kings and the exploitation of noble adventurers. It was to protect private property that the revolution began, but its equalitarian formulae carried it into a criticism of the very property it had risen to protect. How can men be free and equal when numbers of them have no ground to stand upon and nothing to eat, and the owners will neither feed nor lodge them unless they toil? Excessively, the poor complained. To which riddle the Jacobin reply was to set about dividing up. They wanted to intensify and universalize property. Aiming at the same end by another route, there were already in the 18th century certain primitive socialists, or to be more exact, communists, who wanted to abolish private property altogether. The state, a democratic state, was of course understood, was to own all property. It was only as the 19th century developed that men began to realize that property wasn't one simple thing, but a great complex of ownerships, of different values and consequences. That many things, such as human beings, the implements of an artist, clothing, toothbrushes, are very profoundly and incurably personal property. And that there's a very great range of things, railways, machinery of various sorts, homes, cultivated gardens, pleasure boats, for example, which need each to be considered very particularly to determine how far and under what limitations it may come under private ownership, and how far it falls into the public domain and may be administered and let out by the state in the collective interest. On the practical side, these questions pass into politics and the problem of making and sustaining efficient state administration. They open up issues in social psychology and interact with the inquiries of educational science. We have today the advantage of 130 years of discussion over the first revolutionary generation, but even now this criticism of property is still a vast and passionate ferment rather than a science. Under the circumstances, it was impossible that 18th-century France should present any other spectacle than that of vague and confused popular movements seeking to dispossess owners, and classes of small and large owners holding on grimly, demanding before everything else law, order, and security, and seeking to increase their individual share of anything whatever that could be legally possessed.